every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, and the South has porches, and in Alaska we have Arctic countries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Francisco Martinez.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for the show is Indivisible.
We'll hear stories of banding together, falling as one, and reaching across the aisle.
As you might imagine, this show features quite a few interesting circumstances and some issue-driven stories.
We'll start things off on the lighter side with J.C. Croft, who was born in Anchorage.
Like many Alaskans, I love spending time outside, hiking, biking, kayaking, skiing, the works. My brother's like that too, although he's taken a step further. He's a wilderness guide. But that hasn't always been the case. In the summer of 2002, I was a tubby 10-year-old. My brother was a tubby 9-year-old. I liked to sit around drinking soda, eating, reading, playing video games. I wasn't outdoorsy and I wasn't active. I remember being particularly shocked and hurt one time when my parents, on a school shopping trip, told me to go look for husky jeans. While my parents are pretty adventurous people, they're also really lazy. We did a lot of stuff outside in the summers, but when we did, it was things that had a high gear to low activity ratio. We went car camping. We went rafting, which is car camping on water. And a lot of these trips were spontaneous and half-assed. One time we took borrowed four-wheelers and a mini bike back to the campground at the end of Aklutna Lake, and my dad forgot my mom's sleeping bag. You can make of that what you will. Then my mom read about the Russian Lakes Trail in an Alaskan magazine. 21 3/4 miles of trail connecting the upper and lower Russian lakes with three public use cabins connecting them. You can be either hiked or biked. My parents decided to bike it. They booked the middle cabin, Aspen Flats, and the cabin bordering lower Russian Lake, or the Barber Cabin. The problem was, we had never been mountain biking before. My brother and I were luckier than my parents. My grandparents had made it a point in our childhood to buy us a nice bike every summer so that we could pedal our husky selves around town. But my parents were using these heavy, neon green, like, beasts of bikes. And to those bikes, we bolted Walmart special bike racks. And to those bike racks, we bungee corded and boat strapped Walmart special neon yellow waterproof bags. My brother and I were lucky in that we only had to take care of our bags with our clothes inside of them. My parents, on the other hand, were each carrying 70-liter internal frame backpacks. In those backpacks, we stuffed every piece of camping gear that we owned, save for a tent, including a green Coleman 4-burner propane stove. Finally, my dad carried a shotgun. We left Anchorage really late. My parents blame each other for this. I tend to believe them both. But we didn't get to the trailhead till about 5 p.m. My dad advocated staying at a campground nearby and getting a fresh start in the morning, but my mom was having none of it. My mom was often the willpower behind our trips, and this was no exception. When we decided to leave, the thinking was, it's summer in Alaska, we're not gonna lose daylight, and we're on bikes. The 13 miles in the middle cabin will fly by. We almost immediately started walking our bikes. We were going at a reasonable pace, but I would hesitate to call it fast when it got slower. My mom rolled her ankle and fell off the side of the trail into the grass, bringing her bike with her. One of the memories I have from growing up, or continuous memories from growing up, is my mom being in either a walking boot or a ankle brace, because she broke her ankle really badly in high school and was continually re-aggravating it or re-breaking it. And so our obvious initial fear was that she had re-broken it. Luckily, she hadn't. She just twisted it, and it hurt a lot. But after a little bit, she got up, and we kept going. By this point, it was starting to get pretty dark. I had a continual loop in my mind of three things. The bear awareness warnings at the trailhead. My dad saying, "There's tall grass in here. I hope we don't spook any bears," while conspicuously moving his shotgun within reach. And what I, at the time, imagined a bear attacking me would look like. Suddenly, there was a loud noise to the side of the trail. A blur exploded out of the grass, and my dad let out a long string of obscenities. Standing in the trail was a startled and disgruntled ptarmigan. My dad muttered something about it being a lucky bird, put the gun away, and we continued on our way. At this point, we hadn't even made it to the first cabin, which we were supposed to get past to get to our cabin. But my parents decided, occupied, unoccupied, or anywhere in between, we were staying in the first cabin. At every bend or crest in the trail, my dad would say, "I think I see the cabin." And for the first few times, it actually boosted my morale. But the last time he said it, he actually did see the cabin. And we walked up. After a few gruff, "Hello in the cabin," from my dad, it actually was empty. We opened it, and it was fine. That night, we were cold and weary, but we settled in and went to bed. The next morning, we woke up, we loaded our bikes, and we continued on the trail for what turned out to be a wonderfully eventful trip. My brother got charged by a moose. We met a guy from Montana that had bear sprayed himself. I heard wolves for the first time howling. Sure, we didn't make it 13 miles the first day, but we did make it almost 10. And then the next day, we made it almost 10 more. And a few days later, we made it to the car. 21 3/4 miles, together, every mile as a family. Thank you.
That was J.C. Croft, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kendall Stormo.
And I'm Francisco Martinez. We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans.
Brittany Howell is from Detroit, but has lived in Anchorage for about 4 years.
Her bio says she has super sick dance moves, but I'm guessing this story is about something else.
She's also tall, but that's not what her story's about. Time to get serious.
In the summer of 2006, I needed to find a field site. I was a master's student in archaeology at the time, and I wanted to see the world, broaden my horizons, all that. So my local university was going to be of little help. I did what any normal person would do, and I took to the interwebs. Here I found a field director who had a seemingly great archaeological site. He was looking for students, free labor, to accompany him, and the site seemingly had it all. It was in the Peruvian desert. It was previously undiscovered, and there was going to be evidence of ancient decapitations. You know, real Indiana Jones. So I did what any normal graduate student would do, given that opportunity, and I booked the next flight to South America without ever meeting any of these individuals. I arrive in the capital city of Lima. I meet the field director. He's nice enough. His wife is there, who's also an archaeologist. And then I meet the 30 undergraduate students he's managed to recruit, all female. Archaeologists are women. So these students, though, all came from the same university, and they were already friends with each other. And so I'm sort of the outsider. I've also decided I must be too smart for these jerks because I have a master's degree, so I don't make many friends on this trip. We take an 8-hour bus ride to our field site in Peru, made much more miserable by my constant heaving because I was the only one throwing up on this bus ride. But when we get to the field site, it's pretty great. We eat quinoa before it's cool. We also eat guinea pigs, which adorably lived in the house with us. The excavation is also as exciting as I had imagined it would be. The very first day, I find a mummified foot. Suck on that, cool girls. The rest of the trip is equally eventful. We find the remains of 40 decapitated individuals at this site, a cross-section of a population of people that probably lived in the area at the time, which was about 2,000 years ago. There's men, there's women, there's elderly, there's even babies that have been decapitated. And although that might sound terrible to you, it was awesome to us. And by the end of the field season, we were all feeling like Indiana Jones. So just as quickly as it had begun, it ended. A one-month field season is over. We're riding back to Lima for 2 days of fun, shopping, packing, before we head home to our respective countries. In this last night, one of the other uncool girls decided to bring a sex partner back with her, who promptly robbed her of all of her belongings, including her passport and her money. So the next day, I go with her to the police station, not because I speak any Spanish, but because I had nothing else to do. So we're making this police statement in English, and we're asked, what are you doing here? Are you visiting someone? Are you tourists? You know, just so we know who you are and why you're here. Oh, we've just come in from a field excavation. We're on our way out. Could you bring your field director down here to answer some questions? Sure. We call him up, and he's at the police station in 20 minutes, where two police officers come out and arrest him in the lobby. They don't even take him away to do it behind closed doors. They arrest him in front of everybody. Clearly, my Spanish is worse than I thought. Sorry, guys, there's been a miscommunication. That's not the guy who robbed my friend. That's our field director. It becomes clear that this was no mistake. We're separated into two interrogation rooms, this other gal and I. And from the nature of the questioning, it becomes very clear that he is being accused of a sexual assault of one or maybe more of the girls on our trip. This is pretty common in archaeology, where 32% of individuals experience some sort of sexual assault or harassment in the field. The experience was pretty horrifying. We don't know what's going on. We don't know who this has happened to. We don't know if we're going to be stuck here in Peru, if we have to testify, what our legal rights are. We don't have English-speaking lawyers. Eventually, we're released. We fly home in our respective directions. And when I return, I tell my advisor the harrowing end to the story. Yeah, I guess the field season was great, but this terrible stuff happened at the end. And she says, well, of course it did, Brittany. What were you thinking, going on a trip with someone you didn't know? Some man from a different university? And why didn't you form friends with any of those girls? They could have protected you from assault. I hadn't really thought of that. 2 days later, I get a call from an investigator from this the field director's university where he teaches. And she's got questions about my police report. I make another statement. I don't realize I'm under no obligation to do so. I don't realize my name will be put on the statement and that it will become public record. I'm also not making a report of an assault. I'm reporting what any of the women in this audience and backstage and everywhere have probably experienced. Run-of-the-mill sexual harassment, you know, getting handsy, talking pervy. It was normal to me at the time. It's normal to a lot of us. So that was the nature of my report. I wasn't particularly concerned about its content until it got in the hands of the field director's wife. She took some issue to my statements. She started writing me handwritten letters, emailing me, even calling me, because as a graduate student, all of my contact information is available on these interwebs so that my students can contact me. She's harassing me. I'm a lying. I need to retract my hurtful lies. She knew I was going to be a problem. She continues harassing me for years, years. I finally graduate. I become a professor. She gets my new contact information. She's harassing me over 5 years. It makes me wonder, what degree of harassment did the assault victim experience? Is she still harassing her? And what about the victim blaming I received from my advisor? Is it true that I brought this on myself because I traveled while being female? I learned a lot on that trip, and the one thing I'll take away with me forever is how all of us, men and women, intentionally and unintentionally contribute to this culture that allows for the victimization of women. We must all stand, undivided, to let society know that we will not allow unequal treatment, because women are not lesser than, and we are all equal too.
Thanks to Brittany Howell for sharing that story.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is Indivisible, stories of banding together, falling as one, and reaching across the aisle.
Teresa Gray has done a lot since she moved to Alaska 18 years ago. She has owned and operated 3 paramedic schools, flew medevac, ran Ambulance 911, and is currently the director of Mobile Medics International, which provides medical teams to disaster and underprivileged areas all over the world.
Here she is, on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So in mid-December of this last year, I was sitting on my couch in my jammies, scrolling through Facebook, and I came across the picture of a dead 3-year-old in the surf of the Aegean Sea. And I opened up the article and I read it and was horrified to discover he was not the first. And I wondered where the world's outrage was, like how is this possibly happening repeatedly? And somebody should probably do something about this. And then I realized I am somebody. So I turned to my husband and said, I think I'm going to go to Greece. And he said, all right. And I found myself on a tiny island in Greece called Lesvos, with an amazing team helping with the Syrian refugee crisis less than a month later. So we sort of had a routine as a team. We'd get up about 5 o'clock in the morning and we would scour the beaches looking for bodies of the people who had attempted the crossing and whose boats had sunk. Most of the bodies that we found had life jackets on, and much to our horror, we discovered that they were fake. They were filled with cardboard or styrofoam or clothing. I found a pair of baby shoes once. So they were sold a false promise of security, which failed them, and they didn't make the crossing. And we'd do that till about 8 o'clock in the morning, and then we would go to the common boat landing sites, and that's the ones that were the directest route from Turkey to this island. And most of the boats came there, and from about 8 until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we would help Syrian refugees off of the boat. We'd give them dry clothes, and we'd give them food, and we'd give them medical before they were put on the bus and sent to the registration camp. At about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we would go to the registration camp, Moria, which was a former prison meant to house about 2,000 prisoners. And at any given time, there were 3 or 4,000 refugees there waiting to officially seek asylum and continue on their journey. And from there, we'd stay until about 10 o'clock, and then we would go to a very remote lighthouse on the tip of the island, where we'd go up on a giant hill above the lighthouse, and with heat-seeking binoculars, we would look at the Turkish coastline and the water in between Turkey and Greece, hoping to spot boats in the water packed with humanity, so we could send them help before their boat went down. And this went on day after day after day for the 21 days that I was there. A couple of people stood out to me during that time. The first one was about a middle-aged 40, 45-year-old man. As he stepped off the boat, I said, "Welcome." And he looked at me startled, and he said, "Where am I?" And I said, "Well, you're in Greece." And he said, "They speak English here?" And I said, no, I'm American. And he took a step back and he said, "American, why are you here? Americans are afraid of us." And I said, "It's going to take more than one soggy Syrian to scare this American. Like, I'm here to help you." And he threw himself in my arms and he said, "Thank you, Mrs. Thank you. You don't need to be afraid of us. We're afraid of the same things you're afraid of." And then he just sort of disappeared into the crowd as they did. They had to get on their way. The second one was a 17-year-old boy who stepped off the boat and again caught my attention, because when I said welcome, he responded in English. And his name was Kasim. And Kasim's 2 older brothers had been kidnapped by ISIS, and his father had been beheaded in the driveway trying to stop it. And so Kasim's mother had gathered up about $2,000 and gave it to him and said, "Kasim, you have to leave before they come for you next." And so at 17 years old, this boy made his way from Syria to Turkey. and then got on a boat and successfully made the journey and stepped off the boat into my company. And so, you know, after hearing his story and chatting for a little while, we put him on the bus and sent him to Moria. One night in one of my Moria routines, I'm walking up and down the hills of Moria. Lesvos is uphill both ways. Like, it's the only place in the world, both ways. So I'm walking up and down these hills, and we're looking for people that need help, basically. And it is pouring rain, like torrential rainstorm. And I look to my right, and there are literally thousands of people without shelter, without food. They're starving, they're hungry, they're wet, there are infants screaming, there are children, there are old men crying. And the futility of what I was able to do suddenly just hit me. And I put my head back and I put my hands up and I just let the rain hit me in the face, hoping that people wouldn't notice how hard I was crying. I don't think I fooled anybody, but when I put my head down and opened my eyes, out of the crowd comes Kasim. And he's got a hot cup of tea, and he hands it to me, and he hugs me. And he said, "Don't be sad, Mrs. Don't be sad. We are strong Muslim people, and we're already safer than we were. Nobody is killing us. Nobody is making us fight. So don't be sad for us. We're going to be okay." This child comforting me, and I was supposed to be there for him. So from that point forward, for the rest of the time that I was there, I had this bright yellow jacket like they wear up north on the slope, thanks to my husband, so I was easily identifiable. So when I would enter the camp, here would come Kasim with a hot cup of tea, and he would show me the most vulnerable families. He would show me, this family is six and they have no tent, and this family has four children and they haven't eaten in 2 days, and this family has no diapers. And I would turn to my teammates and say, "How much money do you have left? This is what I've got left. I'm going to call my husband and see if we've got anything on the credit card." And we would collectively put money together, go to the store, and Kasim would take me to the neediest people that he could identify, and we would give them what we could manage to buy. And when it was time for me to go home, I was so ready to go home, and I was so not ready to go home. And I'd been home for probably a week when I realized that I can't change the world. I can't make them stop bombing Aleppo. I can't make them stop fighting in Syria. I can't make the Turkish smugglers quit dealing in human trafficking and killing people in the sea. I cannot make Macedonia open its borders so they can continue their journey. I can't do any of that. I can't change the world. But while I was there, I changed that family's world because I got a tent. And I changed this family's world because I found formula for their infant. And I changed that family's world because I fed their children for the day. So even though I can't globally change the world, I made a difference, at least for a day, as best I could. And that's why I'm going back in February.
That was Teresa Gray, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Just a quick reminder that all the past Arctic Entry stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud.
Our next storyteller, Helen Nienhauser, grew up in Pennsylvania and moved to Alaska in 1959. She's made some great contributions to our state since then.
She led the Citizens Initiative to create Cuddy Family Midtown Park. But maybe she is best known as co-author of 55 Ways to the Wilderness in South Central Alaska.
Here's her story.
One January morning in 1970, my kids were in school, and I was reading the paper at the kitchen table. A tiny article caught my eye. There was a bill pending in the legislature that would change abortion from being illegal to being a medical decision between a woman and her doctor. The Alaska Medical Association was going to support it, but wasn't going to lobby for it. And I thought, somebody needs to do that. My concern at the time was about overpopulation and about believing that every child should be wanted. A few days later, another article in the paper quoted Senator Joe Josephson saying that the liberal abortion bill was not going to go anywhere. My Unitarian friends and I were dismayed, and I felt very anonymous, safely anonymous, so I sat down and wrote Joe a letter in which I said, there are a lot of disappointed Joe Josephson supporters up here. To my utter shock, he called me up and invited me to a meeting. That meeting brought together community leaders from churches and from social service agencies and activists. One of those was Jan Erickson, who was an experienced political activist. I suggested to Jan that we get together for another session to talk about what we might do. So a few days later, Prim Babcock, Jan, and I met at Jan's kitchen table. The ad hoc organization, the Alliance for Humane Abortions, was born at that table. And then we realized we needed a chair. Jan was the logical chair, but she said she couldn't do it. I was a stay-at-home mom, and a product of the 50s that defined the role of women as wife and mother. I certainly didn't see myself as a political leader, but this was important. So I said to Jan and Prim, okay, I'll do it. A few days after that, there was a legislative hearing on the bill. I testified in favor of the bill for the Alliance. And suddenly, my phone began to ring with calls of people saying, how can I help? Suddenly, our infant movement became a fast-paced, intense, statewide campaign that went on for 4 months. Five of us, Jan, Prim, Evie Ruskin, Pat Saul, and I, formed a loose steering committee, and we pulled our strengths and planned our strategy. Our key strategy was the letter writing clutch. No email then, so we wrote letters. Who were we? We were mostly women in our 20s and 30s, stay-at-home moms, sometimes with kids in tow. Sometimes we were joined by older women who were retired or whose kids were grown. Why did we do this? Many of those stories I didn't know, but I learned that some had had experience, personal experience with themselves or people they knew, with the tragedy and trauma of illegal abortion and self-inflicted abortion. A few who could afford it had flown to Japan to get a safe and legal abortion, and the rest of us just thought it was the right thing to do. And what we did was about 50 of us opened our homes and invited a dozen or more people to come for coffee and to write letters. And sometimes the hostess provided the stationery and the stamps and the pens, and sometimes the guests did. Collectively, we sent the legislators more mail than they had ever received. Other strategies that we used included petitions, letters to the editor, telephone trees, and mobilizing a lot of organizations to take a public position in favor of the bill. We worked to make it statewide. We worked with communities across the state, the Commission on the Status of Women, and the churches gave us contacts in these communities, and we supplied the contacts with the fact sheets and the organizing techniques. And of course, we worked with legislators. This was Senator John Rader's bill. None of this would have happened without John Rader. In the House, we worked with Jeannie Chance. When we sent our petitions to Juno, hundreds of them, she copied them and put a set on every legislator's desk. When Rader first introduced his bill, he could not get a single co-sponsor. But 2 months into the session, he decided support had grown strong enough that he could bring the bill to the floor. It failed, 10 votes against, 9 votes for, and 1 ill senator absent. Rader was undaunted. Hawaii had just passed the first reform bill in the country. So Rader got on the phone and called Hawaii's attorney general, who dictated the bill, the Hawaii bill, to Rader word by word. No faxes yet either. The new bill, Rader's new bill, was Hawaii's bill, and it was more liberal than the one that had been defeated. On April 1st, he brought it to the floor. The debate on the floor was heated. Now there were 20 senators. Kay Poland had been appointed to her very ill husband's seat. And in the heated debate, when Kay announced her support for the bill, she was attacked by a Catholic male senator. And Kay said, "I am a Catholic. I am adopted. I am, of course, a woman. And I cannot sit here and make this decision for other women." With Kay's vote, the bill passed 11-9. On reconsideration, it passed 13-7. And a few days later, it passed the House 29-10. But the story wasn't over. Then Governor Keith Miller, a Methodist, married to a Catholic, vetoed the bill. But the support held, and the legislature overrode the veto 41-17. And Alaska became the third state in the Union to make abortion, to give women the right to choose. 3 years before Roe versus Wade. There were several factors that helped, contributed to this success. One, I think, was, well, definitely, the changing role of women, the changing attitudes of society and of women. Another was that the today's opposition was not yet organized. And a third was the makeup of the legislature itself. We were still a young state, and that influenced who chose to run. And it was before oil, which changed our politics. This was an incredible victory, and it was a life-changing experience for me. But more than anything else, it was a victory for women. Women banding together, reaching across the aisle, were able to provided the leadership that harnessed and focused the demands of the public and created change.
That was Helen Nienhauser, and this is Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Helen went on to co-found the Alaska Center for the Environment, which is now known as the Alaska Center.
We'll break from stories to hear a song from Todd Grebe and Angela Odin. At Arctic Entries live shows, we feature songs from local artists. You may recognize Todd and Angela from their band, Cold Country.
Thank you.
My wife is a beautiful farmer. She toils in the dirt all day. I am the son of a rich man. I pay portraits for pay. We got 2 little children. You know they grew straight out of the ground. Now it's a little switching. that's a merry-go-round. Yeah, a little beautiful day, living out of town. All my friends are full of laughter, so am I, it seems. A bunch of crazy people living crazy dreams. Living crazy dreams. Yeah, we can a lot of food in the summer, bake a bunch of pies in the fall, and get drunk on rhubarb wine that we made all winter long. Yeah, we walk through the woods on the weekdays, you never know what can be found. Nature's little situations, Lord, such a merry-go-round. Yeah, another beautiful day, living out of town. All my friends are full of laughter, so am I, it seems. A bunch of crazy people living crazy dreams. Living crazy dreams. Crops are so tall, you know they grow straight out of the ground. God's little creation, Lord, such a merry-go-round. Yeah, another beautiful day, living out of town. All my friends are full of laughter, so am I, it seems. A bunch of crazy people living crazy dreams. Living crazy dreams.
Thank you. Probably wouldn't hurt.
One of these days I'm gonna pick up the phone, and me and you can reminisce about all of the good times we've had and all the good times we missed. Happy to say congratulations,
oh joy.
Baby boy, here's wishing you, here's wishing you.
Thought it was first rate.
And one of these days I'm gonna pick up the phone, and me and you can reminisce about
about all of the good times we've had, all the good times we miss. Happiness and congratulations,
oh joy.
I hope your little bundle of loving is a little baby boy. Here's wishing you, here's wishing you.
He's wishing you. He's wishing you. He's wishing you.
Thanks to Todd Grevey and Angela Odeen for the music.
Our next storyteller, Niachan Chuar, is a justice student at UAA. Here she is on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
After another civil war broke out in my home country of South Sudan, my family became internally displaced and took refuge in the neighboring country of Ethiopia, where I was born. From there, we lived in three different refugee camps until we moved to the United States in 1994. The first state we moved to was California, me, myself, my mother, and my two sisters. This was a pivotal time in our lives. It was a time to restore and settle down in this new place we'd call home. From there, we all began our academic journey. Myself and one of my sisters went to the local elementary school. My mother and my oldest sister started taking adult learning classes where they would learn the basics, the alphabets, the numeric system, how to write their names, etc. In addition, my mother also had to join the workforce. Back home, she held jobs in the medical profession. She was a midwife, and she provided aid for the soldiers. Unfortunately, those skills and trainings didn't transfer into the American workforce, where she would only land jobs such as housekeeping, janitorial work, factory jobs. Jobs that paid very little, but required so much physical, hard, manual labor. Work quickly consumed her life, and she had to put her education on hold. Because we were constantly seeking for better opportunity, we moved around a lot. The one move that I vividly remember was our second move. I was in junior high. It was a couple days before summer break, and my mom informed me that we would be moving to Minnesota. I didn't understand what was going on. I was getting ready to go to high school with all of my friends. I was gonna get my very first job where I anticipated on saving money to get my very first cell phone. I had my life all figured out at the age of 13, so I don't know why she was trying to ruin my life once again. It seems like moving became the trajectory of our lives. The only difference is in Africa, we were moving around for safety reasons. Whereas here, although our lives weren't in any imminent danger, we were at risk for such things as poverty and homelessness if she couldn't find adequate work to sustain us. So we went. Another obstacle that she faced due to her language barrier was communication within and outside of her household. Because she couldn't speak much English, she oftentimes needed an interpreter, which was oftentimes provided by the state, but sometimes they just weren't available. When I was younger, I would translate the little things to my mom. I would translate at the grocery store, to the neighbors, or just people in passing. But as I got older, my responsibilities in the household increased, and I needed to pick up more of the translating role. I began doing things such as checking our mail, reading it, understanding it, and relaying the message to her. I had to accompany her to doctor's appointments, both hers and ours, and I had to attend my own teacher-parent conferences. Those became very awkward. When school was going well, it was fine, but when they weren't, it got interesting. One time, my teacher looked at me, and she told me that I basically needed to get my grades up, I was falling behind, and if I didn't do so, I would fail her class. I turned to my mom, and I told her what my teacher said. She looks at me, and every parent knows what this is going to look like. She turns to me, and she goes, which means, my daughter, how can you be failing school while I'm struggling to raise you guys? I felt awful, but it wasn't totally my fault. Other kids in my class had parents, English-speaking parents, to go home to that can help them with their work. I didn't have that because she didn't speak English. She wasn't able to help me with my work. But I continued on, and I became a self-learner. To this day, I do still translate for my mom. It is still a process. But as I get ready to graduate school, I encourage her to go back to school. And although at the time the task seemed daunting and it was oftentimes frustrating, it strengthened our relationship. I was able to gain fluency in my native tongue of Nuer, which I lost along the way of going to English-speaking schools. And she's also, it's forcing her to learn English much better because she has to interpret for me what I need to say in Nuer. So it's beneficial for the both of us. But now as I get ready to walk across the stage to earn a bachelor's degree, I hope she'll return to school, as now we can all provide for ourselves and she can resume her life, and maybe one day I'll be attending her conferences.
That was Niachan Chuar, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Niachan says her friends give her a hard time about her storytelling abilities. She says, now joke's on them.
Our last storyteller, Katie Lawrence, was born and raised in Anchorage. Telling this story is a part of her year of taking epic chances.
Here she is, on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
On a sunny Sunday in 2002, 2 months after I graduated from high school, I was sitting in church, as I often did, holding hands with my boyfriend, JD, and my stomach was roiling because I was 17 years old and 13 weeks pregnant. We had coped pretty well together through our initial suspicions and sneaking into Walmart to buy a pregnancy test that came back positive. But as we drove away from church, my dread multiplied, because that was the day that we had to tell our parents. As I walked up the steps to my dad's front door, I was slow. And I was petrified. And my dad is loving and generous and not stern per se, but I had a fairly strict upbringing. No sugary cereals or snacks in the house. My grades were expected to be high, and I wasn't allowed to date until I was 16. I don't think that my dad made it more than 5 steps in the front door after opening it before I blurted, "I'm pregnant," at his back. He paused and looked at the ground. I don't know how long we stood in silence before he asked, "Well, how long has this been going on?" I didn't really know how to respond. So I said, "A while." He paused again. "What are you going to do about it?" "I'm going to have a baby." At that point, my panic peaked, and so I said, "Okay, well, we still have to tell JD's family, so we're gonna leave. I'll be back later. Bye!" And I practically ran out of the house with JD trailing behind. We drove to JD's house next, and telling his mom was like bursting a bubble of joy around the most kind-hearted person I've ever met. See, JD's sister had just gotten married the week prior, and so she was floating on a cloud of serenity, free from the panic and stress of the wedding, and she was practically singing as she cleaned her kitchen while JD and I sat hip to hip on the sofa in the next room. "Mom, we need to tell you something." "Oh yeah, honey, what?" It's Katie. She's pregnant. Oh, ha ha. No, Mom, I'm serious. She leaned around the door into the living room. What? Katie's pregnant. She walked around the partition wall over to the couch and crack, slapped JD across the face. At that point, then she reached down, wrapped me in the biggest bear hug I've ever felt and said, I'm so sorry. You poor girl. How could you? Now, before you get the idea that this is some kind of Lifetime movie where the lens is gray and everybody is staring tensely at one another, it was actually more like a 90s sitcom where random wacky characters come pouring in from every corner. Once she had calmed down, she got on the phone to call JD's dad and granddad, who were on their way back home from working out at the cabin. She called them up. You need to come home right away. It's Katie. She's pregnant. I'm serious. Hurry home. But remember that this was more than a decade ago, cell service in Alaska on the highway. So what they heard was, you need, hurry, it's Katie. Serious, hurry. Then all of a sudden, bang, the front door opens, and JD's grandma, who rarely left the house with alone, comes barging up the stairs. I had this bad feeling. I felt like something was wrong. I came over. Is everything okay? So then the news comes out. We talk about how far along I am and whether or not I'd seen a doctor. And then, bang, the front door opens again. JD's granddad and dad come racing up the stairs. Is everything okay? JD's granddad asks. It's Katie. She's pregnant. Is that all? We practically killed ourselves coming home on the highway. You said it was serious. I thought she had cancer or something. The room at this point was loud, and it was tense, but it was also supportive. I mean, this wasn't even my family, and yet now it was. Meanwhile, my dad was at home, alone. My dad, who took me to every dance recital, who was the umpire of my softball team when no other parent would step up, who took me traveling and taught me to ski, who had raised me on his own since I was a year old and my mom passed away. I knew I had to go home to him. But I was terrified. I wasn't afraid of him, but I knew I'd have to face his disappointment, his hurt. I'd have to admit to our betrayed trust and admit that I had abandoned a path that he had worked so hard to build for me. When I went home that night, I was alone as I walked up the front steps. I stepped inside quietly, said, hey, Dad, I'm home. I went to my room, and we didn't talk, I mean, really talk, for a long time. But in my dad's dining room, there's a spot on one wall where the paint's worn. That's where my son, John, wrote his ABCs for his grandpa in red Sharpie. And that's because the first home that he ever knew was the house that my dad opened to all of us when we came back from the hospital. It was the house that we spent every summer in between years of college, living in the basement together rent-free so that we could save up money for the upcoming school year. It was that college that my dad and JD's mom took us to help pick out, making sure that they had quality childcare for students who had families. My son, John, is 13 now. Next year, he's going to be a freshman in high school. And JD and I's youngest will be a kindergartner. And every day when My son leaves school. He walks to his grandpa's house, climbs the front steps, opens the front door, and says, "Hey, Grandpa, I'm home."
That was Katie Lawrence, and this has been the Arc to Gentry's Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our website.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Quinn White. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Streams for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. And we have been your guest hosts. I'm Francisco Martinez.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips. Wanna get me some? We fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiry. Darling, I don't need no more reassuring. Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word, would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who can ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim on the same in our new beginning. Don't you say.